Well, it is a real pleasure to be here with you this morning, and it's great to be here at Thomas Jefferson School with all the pride and prejudices that brings. And it's great to be here with President Devines, our student chapter president here at UVA, with Mr. Rick Turner, the president of the Charlottesville branch, and of course with my boss and one of my heroes, Julian Bond. I got a question for you. How many of y'all went up to Washington, D.C. on January 20th for the presidential inauguration? And how many of you watched it on TV? Okay. Y'all are the smart ones. It was cold that day. It was really, really cold that day. The rest of us should have done ourselves a favor and simply read the forecast. I had the benefit of getting that forecast about 2 years prior. I went to meet with my grandfather, see him one of the last days he was alive. He would die at 92. He was the first cousin of Howard Lee Ball and one of Sid's cousins as well. And I told him, that my friends and I were very excited, that we were well on our way to raising what would be about $6 million to help Obama become president. We were raising a fund to mobilize black trade unionists and black media outside the campaign. And it was, we were preparing for the primary season, and I said to him, we're going to make this man president. He said, he's a black guy, right? I said, yeah, that's right. I said, what's his name? He said, Barack Obama. He said, Barack who? He said, Barack Obama. I said, look, this is just one 92-year-old black man's opinion. Born in Petersburg during Jim Crow. He said, and we should preface this by saying that I support everything you do. I always have. But I want to save you a whole lot of heartache. Barack who ain't going to become president. That's just not the way it works in this country. So I was sitting there on January 20th, 2009, with my, he said, it will be a cold day in before Barack Obama comes president. I mean, just to be very clear. Sometimes you come to the university. So I'm sitting there, you can imagine this is going. I'm sitting there on January 20th, 2009 with my NAACP skull cap literally pulled down over my ears, my White House blanket around my shoulders. And I'm looking up at the sky going, Granddad, you're absolutely right. It's a cold day. And he's president. Well, January 20th was one of those days of just when this country reminds us that great leaps of social progress can and do happen. I'm looking right at Ron Walters, who, of course, was one of the architects of Jesse Jackson's campaign and really helped pave the way for that great victory. Was one of those days when it reminds us that great leaps of social progress do happen in an instant in this country, after 100 years of hard work by the NAACP, but in an instant nonetheless. But January 21st came, that day after that great day when the hopes of all children rose in this country. That's what happens when the black guy becomes president. The presidency becomes more accessible to everybody. And especially when a black guy becomes president in a year when everybody knew that a woman would be president. And the next day comes, families wake up to a new morning, same old questions. Why can't dad find a job? Why does mom have to work so many jobs just to make ends meet? There are millions of children in this country who are neglected, not because their parents don't have jobs, but because they have to have too many jobs. Why is my school an embarrassment to everything they teach me that this country stands for? Why are so many of my classmates being diagnosed with HIV? Black kids are 1 out of 7 kids in this country, and 7 out of 10 new youth HIV cases. Why are so many people in my town being sent off to prison? Our country is 5% of the world population and 25% of the world's prisoners. We're 5% of the people on the planet, all colors of people in this country. And we're 25% of the prisoners on the planet. But that's the way it always is. In every century, we have a big dragon to slay. We have a big victory, it seems, in this country. And then we're back to one day just trying to catch up with the day that already happened. There's transatlantic slavery. We fight to end it all through the 17th century, all through the 18th century. At the dawn of the 19th century, It's abolished in this country. It's a great day of jubilation. Hooray, transatlantic slave trade is over, and yet slavery keeps on going. In the 19th century, there's slavery, and then there's the day of jubilation. It rolls across the country. Truth be told, as Dr. Walters would point out, it would roll across the country in some ways for 60 years, until the last chattel plantation was shut down in Alabama in the 1930s. And the next day, your family's in sharecropping. And you're fighting to find jubilation again. 1954, Jim Crow, we make de jure segregation illegal. And for the last 50 years, we've been trying to get beyond de facto segregation and wage slavery and extreme poverty. The new Jim Crow, if you will, the dragon that we have to slay in this century is the over-incarceration of American people. When you say that we're 25% of the world's prisoners, what does that mean? What that means is that if we took all the black and Latino people out of prison tomorrow, our country would still be the leading incarcerator in the world just by a factor of 2 over the global average, not by a factor of 5. It is an incredibly expensive problem. While it may be socially downstream from everything, and it's true, if you fix the schools, eventually the criminal justice system situation should get better, it's financially upstream from everything else. And we're seeing it right now as state budgets are contracting. Everything else seems to be like water in the state budget. Healthcare expenses, education expenses. The one thing that's the rock in that pond is the criminal justice budget. And unless we make take dramatic actions like they did in New York State, the push of the NAACP this year and abolishing the Rockefeller drug laws and sending poor addicts to rehab. You know, just to put them rather than to prison, it doesn't happen. I mean, just to put that in perspective, black people in this country are 15% of the crack users, 85% of people locked up for using crack. And to flip it the other way, white people are 65% of crack users in this country, and 5% of the people locked up for using crack. What does that mean? That means that we already have 2 drug enforcement strategies, and we just simply need to make the one that works for the majority of crack users accessible to all crack users. Poor people need the same thing that rich people do when they're addicted to a drug. They need rehab. They don't need prison. For the NAACP, the way that we attack this, it's by playing to our strength. Our strength is that we, you know, like Mr. Turner, we are local volunteer community advocates in 1,200 communities across this country. That's where we have an active presence, compliant branches who are focused on tackling tough problems. My struggle at the national office is to rebuild the national staff so that we can really coordinate that fight. In the last year, we have increased our revenues by more than 30%. We've increased our national staff by 50%. We've increased membership. Most quarters it's been above 12%. I think right now we're on track to end the year above 10%. And we've done that by being focused, by playing to our strengths, really developing strategies that are based on community organizing and that are based on technology. We've had 2 successes this year with technology that I think really showed some of the future of civil rights organizing. One was a simple program we created called Upload to Uplift. We simply took the online voter registration form that Obama was using, Rock the Vote was using, and we added a Web 2.0 engine that made it possible for you to upload all your contacts from Google or Facebook and blast an online voter registration form to your friends. Other groups hadn't done this, so we decided to give it a try. We did it in the assembly the last 3 weeks, only the last 3 weeks of the national voter registration period. Now, all summer, we had pulled in about 100,000 voter registrations to our database. We knew that there were far more in the field, but we only got about 100,000 into our database. For each one of those registrations, it cost us $7 to $8. To get it done. Even the as a volunteer organization, it's a lot cheaper than groups like Acorn and so forth who pay folks, but it's still quite expensive. We increased that number by 20% in the last 3 weeks. So it's taken us 6 months to accumulate. We increased by 20% in the last 3 weeks, brought down the cost relative to what it costs in the field by 90%. It costs us 76 cents per registration. We also got an equivalent number, so we got about 20,000 new voters, about 20,000 email addresses, about 6,000 cell phone numbers. Any organizer knows just how valuable those last 2 are. This summer, we rolled out a piece of technology called Rapid Report. Our branches have played one dominant role since desegregation. It's to be a triage rooms for families in crisis, the criminal justice system, the education system, the job market, the housing market. But it's very difficult for us to sort of analyze across geographies what the trends are, because those complaints come to individuals. And if they're well organized, they're in a filing cabinet. And so we put a little tool online called Rapid Report that allows people from their iPhone, their BlackBerry, soon their cell phone, but right now from the iPhone, their BlackBerry, and from their desktop to file a complaint of law enforcement abuse or hate crimes. We've received well over 700 complaints just in the last few months. That's, again, without marketing it, we're just kind of beta testing the software. And already we can see patterns, different towns in the South, and we're gathering all the information that the Department of Justice needs to launch a pattern and practice investigation right there, so we don't have to go chase down people. We just assemble it, ship it over, and they can get to work. I put these out there because the reality is that even as we push for human rights victories, and that's what the battle for healthcare reform is right now, it's a battle to extend the social contract, not to enforce an existing one, but to extend it. We still have a lot of work to do to enforce the social contracts that we already have. And the reality is that the rebuilding of the Department of Justice right now in Washington is critical. And it's something that we all need to ensure stays rebuilt. We can no longer afford for this country to play politics with people's basic civil rights and for the sort of dismantling that we saw during the Bush years to ever happen again. With that, I look forward to talking with Julian. Thank you for having me here.